Chapter 6. The message was loaded into the Unisphere through a planetary cybersphere node in Himalayam, a small inland farming town on Westwold. It remained in a one-time address file for 5 hours, long enough for whoever loaded it to have traveled clear across the Commonwealth. After 5 hours were up, the message's sender segment activated. The program distributed the message to every e-butler address code in the Unisphere, an annoying method of advertising called shotgunning. As a method of commercial promotion, it had fallen into disuse centuries ago. Every modern e-butler program had filters that could bounce the spam right back to its sender, although as most shotgunners used a one-time address, there was little point. The e-butlers also automatically notified the RIs, controlling the Unisphere routing protocols, who immediately wiped the offending message from every node. And under intersolar law, finally passed in 2174, anyone shotgunning the Unisphere was liable to a large irritant fine that could be applied to every message that was received by an e-butler, so the penalty was never less than a couple of $1 billion. Subsequently, shotgunning was used only by underground organizations or individuals who had ideologies, disreputable financial schemes, religious visions, or political revolution that they wanted the rest of the Commonwealth to know about. Given how quickly the Unisphere RIs could identify shotgun spread patterns and block them, any software writer capable of composing a decent new shotgun sender could earn themselves a lucrative fee. Cash, of course. In this case, the factor that allowed the shotgunned message to get around most e-butler filters was that it had a genuine author certificate. On the arrival of any message, that was the first thing an e-butler would query. This one had the certificate of April Galar Halgarth, a 20-year-old resident of Solidade, the private world owned by the Halgarth dynasty. Over 10 billion e-butlers allowed it to go forward into their hold file. Most people, upon receiving a message from a Halgarth, opened it from sheer curiosity. When the visual recording started to play, they realized they'd been shotgunned, and 90% wiped it immediately. Those who let it run did so out of native inquisitiveness, the prospect of filing a shotgun suit against a Halgarth, or because they were fellow extremist freedom fighters, or it was useful raw material for their dissertation on modern political factions. A rare few simply believed. The visuals opened with a man in an office, sitting behind a desk, with the snow-cloaked city of San Mateo, Lerma's capital, spread out panoramically through the window wall behind him. His face boasted strong features that were highlighted by dark skin, while neatly trimmed brown hair was threaded with a few silver strands. It emphasized the kind of authoritative air that inspired confidence, marking him down as a positive, progressive leader. Forensic analysis showed he was a graphics composite designed by the Formit 3004 simulator package using its politician sculpture function. "Sorry to burst in on you like this," he said, "but as you probably know, the government spends a lot of tax money on hunting down our group. Contrary to the Commonwealth Charter, which permits free public assembly, I am not allowed to say what I want to other citizens. I represent the guardians of selfhood. And before you wipe this message, I have one question to ask you. Why has the Senate and the Executive chosen to send a starship to the Dyson pair? Specifically, why now?" There was a perspective shift in the pause while the man drew a realistic breath. The observer point moved forward and down, sitting in front of the desk, closer to the spokesman. It was a cozier setting, giving the impression of a one-on-one chat. "As you know, we are campaigning against the Starflyer, an alien we contend is actively influencing the Commonwealth's political classes for its own advantage. It is this Starflyer which has engineered the current mission to investigate the Dyson pair. The Commonwealth has known about the enclosure of the two stars for centuries. We have known that one day, when Phase 6 space is opened, we would reach these strange stars and begin our investigation. What has changed? A single observation that proved the enclosure was a force field rather than a solid shell. Exactly why should that reverse centuries of Commonwealth policy?" The spokesman shook his head solemnly. "Possibly the most critical human voyage of exploration since Columbus set sail has been launched without any valid explanation. The question was not debated openly in the Senate, despite the vast amounts of public money being spent to finance the starship. Instead, the decision emerged from some obscure exoprotectorate council that nobody had ever heard of before. It is exactly the kind of clandestine backroom deal that favors the Starflyer and its agenda. Perspective shifted again, sweeping the viewer out through the window to sort over the complicated maze of San Mateo's streets. Somewhere out there it lurks, controlling and influencing us through its puppets. Government and their media manipulators ask how we know the Starflyer is malign. The answer is simple. If it is a friend, it would reveal itself to us and the other alien affiliates of the Commonwealth. If it is a friend, it would not push us into sending an expedition to the Dyson pair. The President says we need to know what happened. He is mistaken. We know what must have happened. Shielding two entire star systems with force fields is an act of extreme desperation. Something terrible was about to be unleashed, something that warranted such colossal countermeasures. These barriers have kept the threat isolated from the rest of the galaxy for over 1,000 years. We are safe because of that. This wonderful city, and thousands like it across the Commonwealth, sleep soundly at night because the threat is contained. Yet now we are being sent out there to tamper with the dangerous unknown. Why? What was wrong with our old policy of caution? By the time we reach Phase 6 space, we would probably know how to generate force fields of such a size. We would certainly comprehend the science and technology involved. We would not be endangering anybody, least of all ourselves. The view slid back into the office, establishing eye contact with the spokesman again. Why was no public debate allowed? The Starflyer does not want that. Why is there an urgent need to visit the Dyson pair? The Starflyer wants us to. Why does it want that? Consider this. The Starflyer has traveled hundreds of light years across the galaxy. It knows what lies within the barrier. It has seen the danger there. All that we ask is that you resist its strategies and deceits. Question your senator, your planetary or national leader. Demand from them a full explanation of why your tax money is being spent on this undemocratic recklessness. If they cannot satisfy you, then demand your rights. Demand this monstrous plan be stopped. The spokesman bowed his head in respect. I thank you for your time. The star was a blue dwarf, formerly named Alpha Leonis, more commonly referred to as Regulus by intrigued astronomers on Earth, back in the days when there was such a thing as astronomy on the old world. They also found its companion star, Little Leo, an orange dwarf, which itself had a companion, Micro-Leo, a red dwarf. This cozy threesome was situated 77 light-years from Sol, an unusual system that attracted quite a degree of interest and observation time. Then in 2097, CST discovered an H-congruous planet orbiting a long way out from the primary, and christened it Augusta. For Nigel Sheldon, it was the opportunity he'd been waiting for. At that time, the human intersolar commonwealth was being formed, and the UFN on Earth was enacting the first wave of its global environmental laws. With Regulus in a strategically important position to expand the CST network into the already envisaged Phase 2 space, Nigel claimed it for the company. He transported every single CST manufacturing facility out there, and went on to welcome any other factory that was suffering from Earth's difficult new regulations. It became the first of what eventually were known as the Big 15. There was no culture to speak of on Augusta, no nationalist identity. It was devoted solely to commerce, the manufacture of products, large or small, which were shipped out across the Commonwealth. New Costa sprang up along the subtropical coast of the Ceneba continent, the only city on the planet. In 2380 it was home to just over 1 billion people, a centerless urban sprawl of factories and residential districts stretching for more than 600 kilometers along the shore and up to 300 inland. For all its crass existence, the megacity had a sense of purpose upon which all its inhabitants thrived. They were here for one thing, to work. There were no native citizens. Everyone was technically a transient, earning money as they passed through, a lot of money. Some stayed for life after life, workaholics, sweating their way up through the company that employed them, subtly remodeling themselves with every rejuvenation to give themselves the edge over their office rivals. A few stayed for only one life, entrepreneurs, working their asses into an early rejuvenation but making a fortune in the process. However, the vast bulk of people lived there for 60 to 90 years, earning enough to buy into a good life on a more normal planet by the time they finally left. They were the ones who tended to have families. Children were the only people who didn't work on Augusta, but they did grow up with a faintly screwed-up view of the rest of the Commonwealth, believing it to be made up of romantic planets where everyone lived in small, cozy villages at the center of grand countryside vistas. Mark Vernon was one such child, growing up in the Orangewood district at the south end of New Costa. As districts went, it was no better or worse than any other in the megacity. Most days, the harsh sunlight was diffused by a brown haze of smog, and the Augusta Engineering Corp, which owned and ran the megacity, wasn't going to waste valuable real estate with parks. So along with his hood buddies, he power-scooted along the maze of hot asphalt between strip malls, and hung out anywhere guaranteed to annoy adults and authority. His parents got him audio and retinal inserts and eye-spot oc tattoos at 12, so that he was fully virtual, because that was the age for Augusta kids to start direct-loading education. By 16, he was wet-wired for total sensorium interface, and received his first college-year curriculum in hour-long artificial memory bursts every day. He graduated at 18, with a mediocre degree in electromechanics and software. 10 years later, he had a reasonable job at Colin Electromation, a wife, two kids of his own, a three-bedroom house with a tiny pool in the yard, and a healthy R&R pension fund. Statistically, he was a perfect Augusta inhabitant. When he drove home that particular Friday evening, he wanted nothing more than to scream at the planet where it could shove his exemplary life. For a start, he was late out of the plant. The guy on the next shift had called in sick, and it took the duty manager an hour to get cover organized. This was supposed to be Mark's family day, the one where he got home early and spent some quality time with those he loved. Even the traffic didn't want that to happen. Cars and trucks clogged all six lanes on his side of the highway, corralling his Ford Summer. Even with the city traffic routing arrays managing the flow, the sheer volume of vehicles at this time of the evening slowed everybody down to a 55-kilometer-an-hour crawl. He'd wanted a house nearer the factory, but AEC didn't have any to rent in those districts, so he had to make do with the Santa Hydra district. It was only 16 kilometers inland, but that put it uncomfortably close to the Port Clye sector, where one of New Costa's nests of nuclear power plants was sited. Mark opened the Summer's side window as they turned off the highway and onto Howell Avenue, which wound through the Northumberland Hills. It was a district that senior management favored, long clean boulevards lined by tall trees, where gated drives led off to big houses in pretty emerald enclaves surrounded by high walls. It wasn't because there was crime on Augusta, at least non-corporate crime. The well-to-do simply enjoyed the sense of physical separation from the rest of the megacity. Low sunlight gleamed off the district's buildings and sidewalks, creating a hazy, lustrous shimmer. He breathed in the warm, dry air, trying to relax. As always, when the tiny blue-white sun sank down toward the horizon, the warm Eleope wind blew out of the southern desert toward the sea. It swept the day's pollution away, along with the humidity, leaving just the scent of blossom from the trees and roadside bushes. During his childhood, his parents had taken him and his siblings out into the desert several times, spending long weekends at oasis resorts. He'd enjoyed the scenery, the endless miles of flinty rock and sand, with only the rainbow buds of the scrawny twig-like native plants showing any color in that wasted landscape. It was a break from the megacity that was all he'd known. The rest of Cinebo wasn't worth visiting. That which wasn't desert had long since been put to the plow. Giant mechanized farms had spread across the continent's prairies, ripping up native plants and forests, and replacing them with huge fields of GM high-yield terrestrial crops, their leaves awash with pesticides and roots flooded with fertilizer. They poured a constant supply of cheap crops into the food processing factories dotted along the inland edge of New Costa, to be transformed into packaged convenience portions and distributed first to the megacity's inhabitants, then out to the other planets, of which Earth was the greatest market. After snaking down through the Northumberland Hills, Howell Avenue opened out into Santa Hydra, a broad flat expanse that led all the way across to the coastline 25 kilometers away. He could see the Port Clyde Nest in the distance, 11 big concrete fission reactor domes perched along the shore. The ground around them was a flat bed of asphalt squares, where nothing grew and nothing moved, a mile-wide security moat separating them from the megacity that they helped to energize. Pure white steam trickled out of their turbine-building chimneys, glowing rose gold in the evening light. He couldn't help the suspicious stare he gave the plumes, even though he knew they weren't radioactive. The coolant system intake and outlet pipes were miles out to sea as well, reducing any direct contamination risk. But the power plants were all part of his general malaise. Slim pylons carried superconductor cables back into the megacity, following the routes of the major roads before they branched off and split into localized grids. Other, larger pylons carried the cables along the shoreline to the foundries. It was the heaviest industries that had colonized the land above the ocean, the big dirty steel mills and petrochemical refineries that used the seawater for coolant and the seabed as a waste dump. Howell Avenue turned to run parallel with a heavy-duty 8-line rail track. These were the lines that connected the big industry districts to the CST Planetary Station, New Costa Junction, 160 kilometers north and 300 kilometers inland. Kilometer-long cargo trains ran along it all day and night, hauled by DVA-5s, massive nuclear-powered tractor units. The Leviathans roamed all over the planet, some of them on 3-week journeys from the other continents, winding their way through a huge number of different terrains before crossing the final isthmus bridge on Cineba's northeastern corner, which connected it to the rest of the world's land masses. Their trucks carried every kind of raw material available in the planet's crust, collecting them from the hundreds of crater-sized open mines that AEC had opened up across the world. In terms of bulk shifted, only the oil pipelines could rival them, bringing in crude from the dozens of major oil fields AEC operated. The Ford Summer accelerated through a wide concrete underpass as a freight train thundered overhead, heading out from the coast. It was taking refined metal away from the mills, one of 100 that day alone. In a few hours it would reach the planetary station and transfer the metal to a world whose clear air laws wouldn't permit the kind of cheap smelting methods Augusta employed. With that depressing thought at the forefront of his mind, Mark finally turned into his own street. Putney Road was 2 kilometers long, with innumerable cul-de-sacs leading off it. The sidewalks were cracked, and the road surface uneven, long trickles of dark water leaking across it in several places where the irrigation pipes had fractured. Eucalyptus trees had been planted along both sides of the asphalt when the district was laid down 200 years ago. They were now so big their branches tangled together high above the center of the road, creating a welcoming, shaded greenway and providing a great deal of privacy for the houses. A lot of bunting was hanging from the branches, the little flags, all with the silver and blue Augusta football team emblem, sparkling in the center. As Mark turned the summer into his own drive, the tires scattered the usual layer of red-brown bark scabs that had peeled from the trunks to gather in the gutters. His father's car was parked up ahead of him, an open-top 2330 vintage Caddy that Marty Vernon maintained in perfect condition. Beside it, the 12-year-old Ford Summer looked run down and cheap. Mark stayed in the front seat for a moment, taking stock. He wanted all his agitation to fade away so he could enjoy the evening. "I deserve a decent break. Around 20 years." There were noises coming from around the back of the house as the kids played in their little scrap of yard. The eucalyptus trees rustled in the gentle Eliope wind, sending shadows wavering across the roof. Mark studied his home critically. Pale lavender walls of dry coral, with a curving lime-green roof, arched windows of silvered glass, and matte black air-conditioning fins under the guttering, with their front edges glowing a dull orange. Golden scarlet climbing roses, heavily dusted with mildew, had covered the whole south wall up to the eaves, and needed a good pruning. While a blue and white Cathara's vine had attached its suckers to the gable end above the two-door garage, it also demanded attention, and for this the monthly rental took up 15% of his salary. With the utility bill, car payments, his R&R pension, the kids' education trust, the germline modification mortgage, health insurance, the vacation fund, clothing, food, and other regular debit payments, there was precious little left over for enjoying himself. Not that there were many places on Augusta where you could genuinely do that. Suddenly he didn't want to get out of the car. He would throw a damper over the whole evening. Bad day at the office? Mark looked up to see Liz smiling at him through the open window. He grinned ruefully back at his beautiful wife. Another of his daily worries was that she wouldn't be there for him when he got home. Is that what it looks like? She reached in and touched his hand. I've seen happier-looking suicide cases. Sorry I'm late. Work screwed up. He realized she was almost never home late from work. Was that due to experience? He hated reminding himself of her sophistication, the kind that could only be acquired over decades, the years he hadn't lived yet. Come on, she said, and opened the summer's door. You need a drink. And Marty's here. Yeah, I see that. He gestured at the caddy. She frowned in concern as he climbed out of the car. You all right, baby? I think the interface at the office is giving me a headache again. That or the whole goddamn Octatoo is crashing. Mark, you have to complain. You can't come home every day with a headache that gives you cold sweats. If the system's wrong, they have to repair it. Okay, right. I'll talk to the supervisor. She didn't understand how it was at work right now. If he kicked up a fuss, he'd probably wind up getting shitlisted. Don't be so damn paranoid, he told himself. But it was hard. His father was on the patio decking that ran along the side of the pool, sitting on a sun lounger. Marty Vernon was 180 and 8 months out of his latest rejuvenation. Physically, he looked like Mark's younger brother, not yet old enough to develop the thick neck and creased cheeks that was the Vernon family trait. Mark! Hi, son, you look like shit. Come and have a beer. Marty pulled a bottle out of the cooler sheath. His voice was high and excitable. Dad! Barry, aged 5, was waving frantically from the pool. Dad! I can reach the bottom now. Watch! He sucked in a huge breath and ducked his head under the surface, paddling desperately. Mark waved back at his son's splashing feet. Liz dumped little Sandy into his arms. A wet smile beamed out from the thick folds of fabric. He smiled back and kissed her. Tiny hands wiggled about happily. As she had her bottle. 20 minutes ago, Liz assured him. Oh. He rather liked that jaw. They'd collected Sandy from the clinic 7 months ago, and that was after the stress hell that was raising hyperactive Barry. The kids had the best genes they could afford, with Liz paying considerably more of the modification mortgage than he did. It always surprised him how much of a comfort the kids were, and how much stability they brought to his life. Liz just said, I told you so, every time he mentioned it. Having a family was a huge strain on both their finances, especially renting the womb tank for 9 months. But although she'd gone through the whole traditional wedding ceremony with him, Liz flatly refused to have a pregnancy. I did enough of that last time around, she insisted. So the womb tank it was. Mark sat on the spare sun lounger, with Sandy cradled carefully in one arm. He took the beer bottle in his free hand. Barry broke surface with a victorious yell and a lot of splashing. Well done, kid, Marty shouted. Here, go fetch this. He chucked a dollar coin into the pool. Barry whooped and dived down after it. I don't want him worn out, Liz admonished. He'll get all tempered up when he needs to go to bed. Give the kid a break, Marty complained. He's having a ball. And your pool's only, what, a meter deep? That's not going to tire him out. 1.5. Mark gulped down some of the beer. It was an imported brand he didn't recognize. He sighed and settled back into the sun lounger. That was when he noticed the girl sitting in the chair behind Marty. She was wearing a bikini top and some tight shorts, showing off a trim, tanned, teenage body.
"Hi, I'm Amanda."
"Oh, hi." Mark couldn't help the glance he gave his father. "My new girl," Marty crowed loudly. His arm went around her and she giggled.
"Great," Mark said. "So how long have you two,
10 days, Marty said gleefully, "but mostly 10 nights. Amanda giggled again. Mark's smile was fixed. He knew what was coming now.
"We met up in the silent world down at New Frisco Bay. Turns out we had a lot of things in common and...
Hey! One thing in common," Mark corrected silently and sullenly. He couldn't believe his father had done this. Silent World was a Commonwealth-wide franchise. It was the club that all the newly rejuvenated visited. Frequently, in the first few months after leaving the clinic, they went for just one thing, sex. It didn't matter with whom, just someone equally horny from their beautiful, youthful new body's deluge of hormones. There was only one rule: whatever happened inside, stayed inside. You could fuck your worst enemy, or your ex, or your ex's younger sibling or parent, or the most glamorous Unisphere celeb. It didn't matter, because it didn't count back outside the doors. It didn't get mentioned. It simply never happened. And Marty had gone and brought her to a family evening. David turned up 10 minutes later, Liz's 45-year-old son, an accountant working in AEC's export credit division. Then there was Kyle, Mark's older brother, by 115 years, and Antonio, his boyfriend. Joanne, one of Liz's mother's great-granddaughters. Finally, Caris Panther arrived, Marty's older sister, driving up in a Merc coupe and wearing $1,000 casual dress from Jackvin's. Mark was glad she had found the time to come. Caris was the one multi-lifer, apart from Liz, who always made him feel comfortable. She was also the most glamorous person he knew. When she did work, Caris designed dramas that were occasionally made into TSIs by various media conglomerates. They tended to be pretty raunchy. As regulars fell toward the horizon, they ordered Barry out of the pool and fired up the barbecue grill. Caris accepted a glass of white wine from the maid bot and fussed over Barry, helping him dry himself. Barry responded with true puppy-love devotion, showing her his new collection of dead nip bugs. He really adored his aunt, Caris. Mark stood beside the barbecue, turning the burgers and sausages himself. The garden bot had an attachment for it, but he never did trust an array's judgment when it came to cooking.
"You should cut some of these damn eucalyptus trees back," Marty told him, standing at his shoulder. "That solar brick isn't getting enough sun on it during the day, look."
"It should be a lot hotter than that."
Mark looked down at the thick slab below the barbecue's grill, which was glowing a weak cherry pink. Little flames flared briefly as the meat dripped juices down through the grill.
"Looks fine to me, and it's hot enough. It won't last. I've got experience with these things."
"Yes, Dad."
"Marty," Kyle called out. "Sit down and leave the kid alone, for Christ's sake."
Every time his relatives came around, the same thing happened. A lot of the time, Mark felt as if he were a child allowed to listen to adult conversation, laughing when the others did and not understanding why.
"Just trying to help," Marty grumbled as he backed off.
"Next family evening is around at my place," David announced. "I thought we could have it on the 18th. That's when we play our next cup round."
"I'm on for that," Marty said. "You know, I nearly had a trial once when I was first life 18. Newbie City."
"Wrong," Caris said. "You are a trial, Marty, not you had a trial."
Marty made a gesture to which she laughingly covered Barry's eyes.
"I can't believe we've got this far," Kyle said. "We only need what?
A win and a draw to go through to the second round."
"We'll get the win against Sterling, no problem," David said. "But we'll be struggling to get a draw against Taleba. They're football mad."
Antonio groaned theatrically and put his hand to his head.
"How long does this go on for?"
"Another 7.5 months, Kyle told him cheerfully. "And I'm going to the stadium on Tampico to see our last Group 1 game. By yourself, Antonio muttered. 25% of us called in sick when the last game was on, Joanne said. The cup has really taken off this time around. You couldn't get into a bar anywhere in New Costa, they were so crowded. I don't remember everyone getting so excited last time. Wonder if the new aliens will want to play, Liz said.
And what a goddamn waste of time and money that is, Marty complained.
Hardly, David said. We need to know what's going on out there.
Went on out there, Marty said. It all happened thousands of years ago.
That doesn't mean it isn't relevant now, Caris said. The envelopment barrier is still in place around both Dyson stars.
You're sounding like that Guardian shotgun, David said.
Don't tell me you watched it, Marty, Caris taunted. Didn't you realize what it was?
Of course I goddamn well realized, Marty shot back. Only an asshole wouldn't recognize a shotgun.
I saw the highlights on Alessandra Barron's show is all.
Mark turned the sausages, keeping quiet. He hadn't realized the message from April Halgarth was a shotgun propaganda blast until he opened it. And even then he'd let it play. The Guardians had made a great deal of sense. Why hadn't there been a vote in the Senate?
So if it comes from Alessandra, it's acceptable, is it? Caris asked.
Who cares who says it? Marty said. They're both right.
It doesn't affect us, and it's certainly something beyond us at the moment. We should take our time and reach the Dyson pair as we expand naturally, not pull off this crazy Apollo stunt.
Mark flipped the burgers again. Regulus had finally sunk below the horizon, allowing the stars to come out. Brightest among them were the Leo twins, a single glowing orange dot in the eastern sky. He could see them through the leaves of the eucalyptus trees as they swayed quietly. Some nights he'd sit out on the decking with a drink, just staring up at the canopy of stars twinkling above the megacity. They were the physical proof that people did live elsewhere, and live differently. Seeing that made life on Augusta that fraction more bearable.
They put my promotion off again, he said.
Ah, Mark, I'm sorry, Caris said. I know you wanted that.
Tough break, son, Marty said. But you've got to serve aces the whole time to get by on this planet.
And don't try and change the subject that quickly. The goddamn starship is a waste of money.
The point, Dad, is that I didn't get promoted because the company's market isn't growing the way economists predicted. The new factory's on hold. Investment is minimal right now, and not just with us. Phase 3 space isn't growing anything like Phase 2 did at the start. We're not expanding like we used to. The Commonwealth is too stable these days. Population growth is down even with womb tanks. It's certainly not enough to provide a base population for a couple of new planets every year, like we have been doing. We're too civilized and measured. At this rate, we'd never reach the Dyson pair if all we'd do is wait around for CST to open wormholes in Phase 20 space or whatever.
Mark's right, David said. My office has been working some long-range forecasts. We're in a slowdown right now. They used to call periods like this golden ages. Things tick over nicely and there are no upsets.
I thought they were recessions, Caris muttered.
No, there's a difference. It's all a bunch of crap, Marty said. My board isn't making any cutback plans. Our market's bullish.
Nobody's talking cutbacks, David said. The menu is all about reduced growth rates. If anything, Sheldon is playing smart with the Starship project. There's nothing like a sudden deluge of government cash to accelerate growth rates. And the majority of spending is here on Augusta.
That's not the case, actually.
Everybody turned to look at Amanda as she snuggled up close to Marty. She smiled back coolly, completely unintimidated.
My family has a board seat on the first quad bank. I get to see intersolar finance tables before they're massaged. The amount of money spent on the Starship is irrelevant in macroeconomic terms. 20 billion Earth dollars is barely a couple of minutes' worth of exports from this planet.
We're doing well from it, Liz said. Betor UU won the contract to develop bioscreening kits for the Starship.
I didn't know that, Joanne said. Congratulations. Are you working on them yourself?
Some concepts, yes.
One kit. For a super specialist market,
Amanda said. There can be no spin-off from it. I rest my case.
My girl.
Marty leaned over and they kissed quite lavishly. Why do you think there's only going to be one starship? Kyle said.
If you ask me, this is just the beginning. People have really taken to this Dyson Alpha mission. It's going to be bigger than the Commonwealth Cup by the time it's ready to fly. If you ask me, it's a perfect antidote to how moribund Phase 3 space has gotten. Everyone with an ounce of poetry in their soul will leap at the chance of taking off for the wild blue yonder and settling somewhere that CST will never ensnare with their sticky fingers.
Crap, Marty said. If that were true, all these poets of yours would go live on far away.
I meant we could find clean, fresh worlds, not some violent anarchist hell. Not's going to happen, Marty insisted. We've had breakaways before. I bet all those worlds that severed ties with the Commonwealth to be free are all medieval nightmares now. Isolation never works. Look what a mess Earth was in before Sheldon and Ozzy invented wormholes.
Interesting model, Karis said.
One world cut off from the galaxy, Marty said. I rest my case.
David refused to be baited. He just smiled at Mark and rolled his eyes.
Did you hear? They've chosen Wilson Keim to captain the mission, Karis said.
That must really be choking Nigel Sheldon.
Is that a story for you?
Antonio asked.
Could be. Old enemies have to set aside their rivalries for the greater good of the Commonwealth.
Sounds dull, if you put it like that.
Mark started slipping the sausages onto the serving platter. Food's up! Liz took a while in their bathroom getting ready for bed. She had a shower and used some of the smaller, more expensive bottles of scent, dabbing the chilly drops on her skin and massaging them in until the flesh seemed to glow. Then she took out the special cream silk lingerie that she knew Mark really liked. Her jet black hair was combed out until it hung loosely down below her shoulders. Then she put on her gold gown, carefully arranging it so it was almost falling open at the front. She took a contented look in the mirror, reassured once again she'd made the right choice, not undergoing pregnancy for him. Her belly was still as firm and flat as the day she came out of Rejuve 10 years ago, and there wasn't any hint of cellulite on her thighs yet. Back then, her friends had laughed at her dating a first lifer, claiming it was a way of saving on silent world bills. She had to admit, when they'd first met at a party thrown by a production company Karis had been writing for, there was something of the puppy dog about him. He looked so uncomfortable and lost amid all the Z-list celebrities and wannabe production people that rescuing him was the only decent thing to do. They dated a few more times, and she'd enjoyed herself because he was enthusiastic about life and the Commonwealth and didn't have the kind of guarded falseness of people her own age. There was no game playing with him. He was too honest for that. She found that inordinately reassuring. So maybe it really was a case of subconsciously hoping his genuine youth would rub off on her, even though the age difference had never been an issue for him. Then, completely out of the blue, he'd asked her to marry him, carried away by some mad romantic notion of them being soulmates. She'd been so close to saying no, a hard, fast put-down that would hurt him for a month until he met some equally wild, inexperienced girl his own age, and they went off into the sunset together. Except, why should she actually do that? So what if he was sweet in a puppy dog way? Men who were thoughtful and considerate were rare, no matter what their age. She was going to live forever anyway, or a damn good portion of it at least, so why not be happy with a good man for 20 years or so, and to hell with her jealous friends and their catty remarks? Since then there hadn't been a single day when she'd regretted the decision. They fought, what married couple didn't, but never over anything serious. He was a wonderful father, too. She'd never planned on having more than one kid with him, but just being together with him over the years made her give in and agree to Sandy. And her friends had been right. Healthy first lifers his age took a lot of satisfying in bed, which made her the lucky one. There was only one bedside light on when she stepped out of the bathroom, casting a warm yellow glow on Mark's half of the bed. He was sitting up studying data on a paper screen. The window was open and the air conditioning off. Dying gusts of L.A.O.P. warmed the room.
Hi, baby.
Is there room there for Mummy?
Mark looked up. A nervous smile flickered across his face as he saw what she was wearing. He dropped the paper screen as she clambered onto the bed and slowly crawled toward him.
That Amanda looked quite something, she murmured as she nuzzled his ear.
Pah, she does nothing for me, not like you.
He slid one hand inside the gold gown, fingers stroking the hot ebony skin beneath the fabric.
Liz slowly moved around until she was straddling him. She planted light, tickling kisses on his cheek and down his throat.
Her head waved from side to side, allowing her hair to brush across his chest. His hand slipped under the camisole. She smiled at the pleasurable sensation his fingers conjured and brought her head up to kiss him properly. Then she saw his face and sighed heavily.
What's the matter, baby?
She rolled off him, dismayed and concerned.
This isn't like you.
Mark stared up at the ceiling, unable to meet her gaze.
It's nothing.
Wrong. Believe me, I know. I am your wife, and a lot more besides. She deliberately paused as she retied the robe tighter. His smile was regretful.
I know. It's just that tonight wasn't what I was hoping for. I'm sorry.
I think this is a little deeper than your father turning up with his latest lady friend, however tactless it was.
Damn it.
He turned on his side to face her.
That's exactly it. Don't you see?
See what?
You, Dad, the others. You've all got this wealth of experience, and I don't. And it gets a little overpowering at times.
And you didn't get the promotion.
Jesus H. Christ, you just did it again. Do you have any idea how small that makes me feel?
Liz was quiet for quite a while as she gathered her troubled thoughts together.
I didn't realize the effect was this upsetting. It's never been an issue before.
I know.
He grinned lamely.
Maybe it's a cumulative thing.
Okay, baby. Then I'll say one more thing that I think about you.
What?
You really hate it here, don't you?
Mark let out a relieved breath.
Yeah.
Then he was suddenly animated, jumping up to give her an intense stare. This whole world is strictly for adults only. And I don't mean me. I'm only 28, for Christ's sake. That's not adult. They shouldn't let anyone through the gateway at New Costa Junction until they're at least 100 years old. You're the only kind of people who can take this kind of life.
All right, she said.
I admit it doesn't bother me as much as it obviously does you. That's because it's temporary, baby. One day we'll leave. But not together. That's part of you as well, that fatalism or wisdom, whatever you want to call it. Nothing ever seems to bother you. You've had other marriages. They're just sections of your life. You're my whole life, Liz, you and the kids.
I know I'll get out of here one day, but it won't be with you.
And this world isn't for children. There's no society here. That's what I hate most about all this. Barry and Sandy are going to grow up just like me. That's so much the worst thing I could ever do to them.
Okay.
She put a finger on his cheek, turning his head so she could look straight at him.
Tomorrow you hand in your resignation, and we start looking through the Unisphere for somewhere else to live.
Somewhere different. Maybe a Phase 3 world.
You can't. You're not serious.
Perfectly serious. This is eating you up. You don't have to be my age to see that.
And, Mark,
I meant everything I said at the altar. I do love you. And if we stay here, we're going to get torn apart. So, this is what we have to do.
But what about your work? The stuff you do at BitOrUU is real cutting edge.
So?
There are tens of thousands who can do the same thing, hundreds of thousands, actually. And I don't really need to be in the labs the whole time. I can work most of the systems over the Unisphere. Then again, maybe it's time for me to get a new job if we are going to live somewhere different.
Jesus.
Mark looked shocked. Then he began to smile.
My God, do you know what they'll say if I tell them I'm quitting? Burkham will go crazy.
Let him. Who cares?
But what about money? We'll never earn as much anywhere else. Not doing what we do now.
Pay is relative. Augusta costs a lot more than most places. We'll find a world where our jobs support this kind of lifestyle, if not a better one. He held her close. The expression on his face was the same kind of wonder as the first time they'd gone to bed together. You'll really emigrate with me. Yes, Mark. You're not just some section of my life, baby. You are my life. Who knows? Maybe we'll be the 1 in 100 billion couples who actually stays married for all eternity. He grinned. I like that idea. You got any thoughts where you'd like to go? You've obviously been thinking about this for a long time. Since I was about 5. His hands moved down to the gown's belt and gently pulled the bow open. But we can talk about that in the morning. An hour after the case broke, Tarlo and Rennie accompanied the Directorate Duty Forensics team to the Paris CST station, where all of them climbed on board the express for Nzega. They routed via Orleans, the Big 15 world for that sector of Phase 2 space, and arrived at Fatou, Nzega's capital, 41 minutes later. The forensics team hired a van to carry their equipment, while Rennie and Tarlo checked out a big BMW 4x4 range cruiser. Nzega wasn't a backwater world, but it had managed to sidestep the excesses of full techno-industrial development. The majority society was stable, civilized, and took a decently relaxed attitude to life and human foibles. Its main body of initial settlers were Polynesian and Latin Americans. They came because of the seas. Half the planet's surface was water. Nzega didn't have any major continents, just hundreds of large islands and thousands of smaller ones. That gave them an awful lot of coastline. The economic spin-off was the colossal number of resorts, hotels, and rental properties along the shores of the islands. Combined with the planet's liberalism, it attracted a lot of middle-class kids looking for a break from the worlds with a faster pace of life. Rennie loaded their destination, Port Launay, into the BMW's drive array, and settled back to enjoy the view. It was a 17-hour drive from Fatou along the Great Mantou Road, taking them over innumerable causeway bridges and 5 ferry rides between the islands into the subtropical zone. Sometimes the road was enzyme-bonded concrete, sometimes not. There were times when it ran along the top of sheer cliffs, and others when it meandered through what seemed like endless salt marshes, while the rest was just a standard route through the string of coastal towns. After a while, both investigators opaqued the windows and settled down to sleep while the vehicle rolled along. Port Launay was simply a 4-kilometer section of the urban strip that ran along the whole shore of Kailindri Island, though urban was pushing the definition a bit. The single compacted stone road ran along 200 meters inland from the sea through an unbroken forest of shaggy native trees, with small cul-de-sacs branching off, where clusters of chalets and bungalows sheltered under the branches. Towns were identifiable only by the way shops and commercial buildings clumped together to serve residential neighborhoods. When the BMW's drive array indicated they'd reached their cul-de-sac, Rennie switched to manual to steer the car along the last few hundred meters. The road wasn't even broken stone anymore, just tire tracks of dusty sand in the dense yellow-blue queen grass. 3 local police cars were blocking the way. Several rented cars were parked on the verges in front of them, with reporters arguing with police officers. "How did they get here so goddamn fast?" Tarlo asked. "Who knows?" Rennie said. "They smell misery the way vultures smell carrion. You want to deal with the local police?" "Sure." Tarlo grinned, slipped his sport sunglasses on, and opened the door. She watched him saunter over to the sergeant in charge. Tarlo was from Los Angeles, 82 years old. Not that he gave that impression in the flesh. 9 years after his first rejuvenation, he still looked as if he was barely out of his teens. His wealthy California family had contributed extensive germline sequencing, one facet of which restricted his natural aging process. They'd also gone for a traditional, or stereotyped, depending on your viewpoint, surfeit appearance. Slim body, but tall and naturally toned, with lush blonde hair and perfect teeth set on a firm, square jaw. Tarlo clearly relished his heritage. Why he'd gone into law enforcement was something Rennie never understood. "I like puzzles,"
was the only explanation he'd ever offered. Personally, she felt he got slightly too much of a buzz out of the directorate's covert operations. The little boy who wanted to be a super-secret agent when he grew up. He ought to fit in just fine on Nziga, which was why she was happy to let him talk to the police. Sometimes there was a lot of resentment within the local law enforcement agency when the directorate turned up and took over. She saw the forensics team's van pull in behind the BMW just as Tarlo and the sergeant laughed together. One of the police cars was driven off the track it had been blocking, and Tarlo waved her through. The beach cottage was another couple of 100 meters down the track. Tall trees with grey-blue leaves lined the track, providing a degree of privacy for the homes along the cul-de-sac. She caught glimpses of the single-story buildings, built mainly from wood or composite panels. One had been grown from dry coral. A black Merc had drawn up outside the cottage she wanted. Rennie had a good idea who that had brought. She parked the BMW behind it and climbed out into strong humidity and the strong smell of salt water. The trees provided reasonable shade from the fierce morning sunlight, but she still put her own sunglasses on. "The Halgars sent their own security team," Tarlo said as he walked up beside her, holding his linen jacket over his shoulder. He nodded at the Merc. "Police said they arrived about 40 minutes ago. How do the police feel about us being here?" He grinned his broad grin, pleased to hand the whole problem over to us. "They'll handle crowd control until Miss Halgarth leaves."
"Good."
She watched the forensics team van jolt its way along the track. "Do we know which house the Guardians operated out of?"
"Yep."
He pointed along the shore. "Two down. They obviously had good intel. Police have put a guard on it. The reporters don't know about that yet."
"Okay."
Rennie straightened her shoulders, adjusted her light jacket.
"Let's get this over with. Put your jacket back on." "The boss isn't here."
"That's not the point."
With a great show of reluctance, Tarlo put his jacket back on and pulled his tie up.
"There'd better be air conditioning,"
he muttered as Rennie told the forensics team to start with the other house. They walked down the narrow front path to the beach cottage. It was a modest little building made of wood that had been freshly painted lime green, with a solar cell roof and semi-organic precipitator leaves hanging from the eaves. A wide veranda faced the sea. Only the rear and sides of the property were fenced in with trees, giving the cottage a grand view out across the broad cove. A barbecue stood at the end of the veranda, with several chairs and a table on the grass beside it. Empty bottles of exotic cocktails, beer cans, and dirty plates occupied the table, glistening in the fast evaporating dew. One of the Halgarth security personnel was standing in front of the door, dressed in a simple navy blue sweatshirt and long beige shorts that came down over his knees. Rennie tried not to smile when they walked up to him. His image was obviously something he felt strongly about. "Serious Crimes Directorate," she said solemnly. "We'd like to interview Miss Halgarth."
"Sure thing," he said. "Some identification, please?"
Rennie's e-butler sent an SCD certificate to his e-butler.
"Thank you,"
the security man said. He opened the door for them. The cottage wasn't large. A narrow hall led to 3 bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchen, and a living room, which took up half of the total floor space. The furniture was functional rather than ornate, a typical low-budget holiday rental.
"She's a Halgarth, and she comes here for a vacation," Tarlo said. "Even if she's minor family, she could stay someplace better."
"That's not the point. Didn't you access the file?"
"This is her first year at college, her first vacation with a bunch of friends. She's free of the family for the first time in her life. Anyway, what's wrong with this place?"
He winked. "No moon. No tides." His voice dropped to a deliberately hoarse whisper.
"No surf."
Rennie gave him a despairing look and went into the living room. April Gala Halgarth was sitting on the settee, looking as woebegone as if she'd just been told her parents had undergone complete body loss. Even dressed in baggy green jeans and a rumpled old russet t-shirt, she was quite beautiful. A tall 20-year-old with smooth, light ebony skin, thick wavy hair, and sweet features that belonged on an even younger face. Her hands cupped a mug of coffee that she wasn't drinking.
when she looked up at the two investigators. Her eyes were red and puffy, desperate for understanding. Her three girlfriends were standing guard protectively around her. Mariana, Angelia, and Laura, all from Queen's University Belfast, where they studied together. Two more Halgarth security personnel were also in the room, looking slightly lost. Their orders were to protect April from the media and escort her home. The girl clearly wasn't up to that much activity yet.
"Have you caught the bastards?" Mariana demanded when Rennie and Tarlow identified themselves. She had a thick Irish accent.
"Not yet, no," Tarlow said. "We're just establishing the investigation."
"Huh," Mariana snorted. She turned her back on the two investigators.
"Miss Halgarth, we need to ask you some questions," Rennie said.
Mariana knelt down beside her friend.
"You don't have to if you don't want to."
April peered up at Rennie.
"It's all right. I want to do this."
Mariana nodded reluctantly and led the other two girls out of the living room.
"If you don't mind," Tarlow said politely to the remaining bodyguards.
One went out into the hall, the second left through the sliding glass door and stood on the veranda outside.
"I guess you must be wondering why this happened to you," Rennie said as she sat beside the distraught girl.
"Yes,"
April moaned. "Mostly because you're a Halgarth. The guardians of selfhood regard you as their enemy."
"Why? I don't know anything about them. I've never been to Faraway or helped any aliens or anything. I'm just studying 21st century history, that's all."
"I know, but your dynasty is the main backer behind the Marie Celeste Research Institute. To their warped minds, that's a big crime. I have to tell you, don't look for reason in this. There is no true rational explanation. You are the result of a search program. They wanted a Halgarth. It's always a member of your family, and one who is, I'm sorry, slightly naive and isolated. It was your name which popped up out of the program." April bent her head, dabbing at her eyes with a paper kitchen towel.
"It was so nice. I can't believe this."
"What was his name?" Tarlow asked gently.
"Alberto," the girl said. "Alberto Rosanto. He was with his friends Melissa and Frank in the cottage one down from here. They were doing the same thing as us, taking a spring break."
"They said." "I suppose that was a lie."
"Yes,"
Rennie said. April winced as she stared into the cold coffee.
"So you met them?" Rennie prompted.
"He was lovely. He had these big green eyes. I thought he was a first lifer just like me. They were on the beach the day we arrived. We all started talking. There was a little bit of competition for Alberto, you know. I mean, Melissa and Frank had each other, and there were four of us. We sort of gathered around Alberto, and Mariana's really pretty. She always gets the best boys, but he liked me. He was always smiling when we spoke, and he was easy to talk to. He had a lovely smile, really lovely. So it was like me and him for the next few days. We went swimming, and he was teaching me how to windsurf. We all went out in a group to the bars in the evening and had too much to drink. I even tried some TSI narc. Nothing hard. Just some low programs. They were weird, but kind of fun. I suppose that was the start of it."
"They'd be establishing a pattern, yes," Tarlow said. "A TSI narc, or even ordinary chemical drugs, help blur your recollection. I'm sorry, April, but we have to ask this. Did you sleep with him?"
"Uh-huh."
"When, please?"
"I suppose the first time was 4 days ago."
"And you stayed over at their cottage when you did?"
"Yes. He had a room of his own. I'm sharing with Laura. We all made a pact about boys before we came here, that we'd use the couch if a roomie scored. But I just... this was easier."
"More private," Tarlow said with a sympathetic smile.
"Yes," she said eagerly. "I'm still a bit conservative, I suppose. Not that I mind my friends knowing I'm with a boy, but the walls here are really thin. I grew up on Soledad, which is just family."
Her head came up, giving them a dejected look.
"You must think I'm a really dumb rich girl who knows nothing about the real world. Nobody else would be so gullible."
"No,"
Rennie said. You're not gullible. It's not that kind of contrick. They would have got the Unisphere message author certificate out of you no matter what.
The tears filled her eyes again.
But I don't remember. And now the whole Commonwealth thinks I sent them Guardian propaganda. By tomorrow the Commonwealth will have forgotten. Your family will make sure the news media never mentions you again. Normally I'd complain about undue influence, but in this case I have to agree it's a blessing. April nodded slowly in agreement.
What happened?
She asked with a fierce whisper. The family security people said they didn't know, but I'm sure that's what they were ordered to say. Tell me, please.
She looked from Tarlo to Rennie.
Please. I have to know. I can't even work out when. That's so awful. I don't care how bad it is. I just want to know.
It would have happened two nights before they left, Tarlo said. Rennie flashed him an angry glance, but he just shrugged. Part of the routine of getting you drunk and high each night is that you wake up the next morning with a fuzzy head, so that when they take the next step, you don't even realize. April frowned, her eyes unfocused as she gazed out through the broad window wall, concentrating on something way beyond the sparkling sea.
I don't remember. I really don't. I'd like to say I was more sluggish than usual that morning. But I wasn't.
She looked up at Tarlo.
So what happened to me?
They would probably have given you antrinoine or some variant. Slipped it in your drink. You wouldn't know what was going on. It's almost like being blind drunk, except you're completely open to suggestion. Then they'd have used an interface scanner in conjunction with a hack program on your inserts. It wouldn't have taken more than a couple of minutes. After that, you would have had a memory edit.
Memory edit?
April ran her hands back through her hair.
You make it sound so clinical. That's a piece of my life they stole from me. I never knew it could be that easy.
The technology is well established, Rennie said. Some of the refinements didn't even come out of corporate research. The first thing criminals do after they've committed a big crime is erase any record of the event from their memories. They don't even know they've committed the crime, which is kind of weird. But that way, we can't read their memories and use them as evidence in court.
You know, I think I hate that part more than anything, more than being seduced or having my certificate used. It's just awful. They could have done anything, anything. I'll never know. I can't believe I don't remember.
We'll need to run some tests on you, Rennie said. Our forensics team will take some blood samples. Given this only happened a couple of days ago, we'll be able to find traces of whatever drug they used. They'll also want to run some calibration programs through your inserts.
Do you think you're up to that for us?
Yes, April said. Whatever it takes, I'll do it. Thank you. We'll use a characteristic sketch program to get a picture of them. You and your friends can contribute to that.
Are you going to catch them? Realistically?
It will be tough, Tarlo said. The Guardians wouldn't have shotgunned their message until after their team was off in Zega. By now they could be on any world in the Commonwealth. They'll use cellular reprofiling kits to change their appearance. Our best chance of arresting them is when we break the whole Guardians group.
You've been after them for a long time, haven't you? Everyone knows that. It's Paula Mayo's only unsolved case.
Nobody can run forever, Rennie said. Today will have brought them a little closer to justice. They will have left clues and evidence. Their DNA will be in the cottage. Their software patterns will be all over in Zega's cybersphere. In the finance for renting the cottage and hiring transports, their communications records. I know it doesn't sound like much to you, especially now, but believe me, every little bit does help us. Rennie and Tarlo left through the veranda window, sending the bodyguard back in. They walked over the spongy lawn toward the cottage the Guardians had used. Both of them had to slip their sunglasses back on against the glare of the hot sun.
That was kind of you, Rennie said, telling her they would have used a date rape drug.
I wondered what you were doing telling her about the hack. She suffered enough, Tarlo replied. Rennie stopped and looked out to sea, a humid breeze toying with her thick auburn hair.
Bastards. Fancy doing this to a first lifer. Even without the memory, she'll be screwed up about it for decades.
I hate memory edits, Tarlo said. Every time we come up against it, it gives me the creeps. I mean, suppose we already solved the Guardian's case.
started to round them up. When they turned it on us, we might have arrested them 100 times already. I mean, it is goddamn strange that the boss has never got one of the principals. You're starting to sound like Alessandra Baron, always criticizing the directorate. If anyone invented a memory edit you fired like a laser, we'd know about it. That's the whole point, he said, shrugging, his arms held wide. We did know about it, and the inventor fired it at us. Stop it. You're getting paranoid. He grinned ruefully. You have to admit, something's not right about this whole Guardian situation. Hell, you were there on Verlaine's. Did we make a mistake? Come on, I mean it, did we? We played that so by the book we got paper cuts and they still found out. They got lucky. They've been lucky for 130 years. That ain't natural. She gave him a troubled glance. What are you saying? I don't know. I really don't. He sighed. Come on. Let's go find out what forensics turned up. It'll be nothing. Optimist. $10 that this is the time the Guardians made a mistake and left a decent clue behind. You're on.